Hello, and welcome to episode 7, The King Who Never Smiled. Razia's death in 1240 CE left her brother Bahram Shah on the throne of Delhi. As you would no doubt recall, he had promised Aitigin, the noble who led the conspiracy against Razia, that he would make no attempt at ruling on his own. Even as Razia was on her way to Lahore, this alliance fell apart. Bahram Shah was greatly annoyed by Aitigin's new practice of keeping an elephant at his residence and having drums beaten for him when he entered or left. That was a privilege reserved for the Sultan alone. Within just months of coming to power, he had Aitigin murdered and appointed his own chamberlain in his stead. This alienated many of the nobles, and they had tried to switch sides to Razia. But her death dashed their hopes, and they were left to nurse their wounds. Bahram Shah made himself even more unpopular when he executed a Qazi on the advice of a Sufi. Up to this point, the Sultans had been vehemently opposed to the Sufis and favoured the orthodox ulema, and Bahram Shah's actions pushed the ulema into an alliance with the nobles who were conspiring to depose him. This conspiracy bore fruit when Bahram Shah was murdered in 1242 CE and his brother, the 16-year-old Masud, was placed on the throne. I'd like to pause here for a moment to introduce fully one of the key players in the drama that's unfolding, the notorious Forty. Writing about 60 years after the events being described here, the chronicler Ziauddin Barani talks of a group of nobles he calls Turkan-e-Chehilgani Bandagan Shamsi, which literally translates to the 40 slaves of Iltutmish. It was apparently they who had been behind the frequent deposing and enthronement of sultans after the death of Iltutmish. The existence of such a group of 40 former slaves has been doubted by modern historians, as Juzjani, a writer who actually lived during this period, makes no mention of them whatsoever. It is concluded, therefore, that there wasn't such a group of 40, although there probably was a body of former slaves who attempted to be the real powers behind the throne. But for the convenience of this narrative, we'll continue to call them the 40. In order to ensure their own control of the court, the 40 appointed a fugitive Ghurid prince as Masud's vizier or prime minister, assuming that the latter would, in his gratitude to them, let them run the show. That again did not happen, and predictably, the 40 had him murdered and replaced with yet another pliant candidate. This time, in order to ensure that the Prime Minister didn't get any bright ideas, they appointed one of their own men as his deputy to keep an eye on him. This man was a young former slave of Kipchak origin, named Ghiyasuddin Balban. Balban was an ethnic Kipchak, a group of nomads who lived north of the Caucasus in what is today southern Russia. They had been defeated by the Mongols as the latter swept westwards towards Europe, and many of them were sold as slaves in the markets of the Islamic world. This meant that by the time of Masud's ascension to the throne, there were many in the nobility who were intimately familiar with Mongol arms and tactics, having faced them in battle before. This fact is going to be very important to us when, as some of you probably know by now, Balban takes the throne for himself. For now, though, he was happy to play the role of a puppet master. While keeping the 40 busy with the Mongol problem, he filled all the top posts in the administration with his own kinsmen and basically pulled the carpet from under the feet of the nobles. By the time the 40 realized what was happening, Balban had emerged all-powerful. In 1246 CE, he went even further and deposed Masud, replacing him with Iltutmish's grandson, Nasiruddin Mahmud. Now firmly entrenched in power, Balban looked around and took stock of the situation. A great deal had changed since the death of Iltutmish. On the western frontier, the Mongols were becoming increasingly aggressive, causing many governors to defect to their side. They were even able to occupy Lahore and ravage the Punjab annually. In the east, the governors of Bengal were once again withholding tribute, and encouraged by their example, the governors of Bihar and Awadh were also doing the same. Meanwhile, the Ikta system that had been established by Iltutmish needed reform, and most pressingly, the army was now in dire straits, since the Turkish horse archers and their horses were in short supply after the Mongol conquest of Central Asia. So our man Balban got straight down to work. Knowing that he needed the army to just hold on to whatever territory he already had, he resisted any pressure to undertake new conquests. Rebellious governors were ruthlessly crushed, and a slew of infrastructure projects were taken up to allow faster deployment of the army and more effective collection of revenues. Those chieftains who couldn't be defeated in open battle were played off against each other, and Delhi's authority covertly exercised through a network of spies and political agents. Appeasement was the standard response to the Mongols, and expeditions were only sent against them if things got out of hand. The army was also reorganized to include locally recruited men who fought as infantry, and tactics were revised to decrease the dependence on cavalry. Nasiruddin's rule was largely a tranquil one, thanks in no small part to Balban. The only source of frustration for Delhi was the continued defiance of Bengal. Armies were sent against it, but they were largely unsuccessful in bringing it to heel. In all, though, things were going pretty nicely, with the Sultan not bothering himself with the cares of office and Balban running an energetic and efficient administration. So nothing much changed in 1265 CE when Nasiruddin Mahmud suddenly died, leaving no heirs to the throne. A few eyebrows were raised when this was followed by the death of several of Balban's rivals under mysterious circumstances. But if anyone had any suspicions about him, they had neither reason nor the courage to voice them. For 19 years, Mahmud had sat on the throne while Balban ruled the Sultanate. Now that the royal seat was empty, Balban dispensed with the charade and crowned himself Sultan. Although for the man on the street, this made no difference. After all, Balban the Sultan was no different from Balban the de facto Sultan. Looking back today, it's hard to miss the sea of change that his ascension brought to the course of history. As the world around him convulsed in the wake of the Mongol conquests, Balban's policies transformed Delhi from just another center of Islamic power to the most powerful center of Islamic power. His policies and reforms would have a lasting impact on Indian history. The first of his innovations was ideological rather than material. In 1258 CE, Hulegu, Chinggis Khan's grandson, had sacked Baghdad and executed the caliph and his family. Although the sultans of Egypt claimed that some of his children had escaped to their court, for all practical purposes, the Abbasid caliphate had ceased to exist. So far, the sultans in Delhi had claimed legitimacy to rule on the grounds that they were the deputies appointed by the caliph. Now that the caliph was gone, they would have to look for new grounds to justify their power. Balban found just such an ideology in pre-Islamic Iran. On coming to power, he began to portray himself as God's regent on earth, whose word was God's word. He claimed descent from a mythical Turkish king in Iranian folklore, and introduced into his court ceremonies such as the sijda, which was the ceremonial prostration before the king, and the paibos, which was the kissing of the ground at the king's feet, all of which were distinctly pre-Islamic Iranian traditions. He made it clear to everyone that he owed explanations to God alone and refused to speak directly to courtiers. The court was always elaborately decorated, and he would always appear in it dressed in full regalia. Idle talk or joking was strictly forbidden, and nobles had to stand in court with their heads bowed down all the time. He himself would remain stern and aloof, thus going down in history as the king who never smiled. Although he did not know it at that time, this change in ideology would become the dominant one in India. Over time, the traditions of Persian kingship would mix with the Indian traditions of kingship, and the result would be the divine god emperors of Mughal India. At that time, though, that didn't make him very popular with the elite. To them, he was not only a megalomaniac, but also a rabidly racist hypocrite who considered noble genealogies more important than talent, while he himself was a former slave. His claim that he was God's regent on earth and his open support for the Sufi orders amounted to blasphemy in the eyes of the ulama, and his overzealous dispensation of justice alienated many of his closest supporters. He didn't care though. Always surrounded by an armed guard with swords drawn and aloof from the public, there was little anyone could do about him. The second change he oversaw was more short-term. In the 1260s, the Mongol Empire imploded as the descendants of Genghis Khan turned on each other after the death of his grandson, the great Khan Mongke. In the aftermath of the Mongol Civil War, the empire split into four independent khanates and sent a deluge of fugitives to the Sultanate. Recognizing the immense value of having Mongol insiders in his service, Balban allotted them lands to settle in and recruited them into the army. With the Mongol world in disarray, his armies augmented with Mongol warriors and his newfound first-hand knowledge of Mongol warfare, Balban felt confident enough to adopt a more hostile posture on his western frontier. He began by building a series of fortifications along the Indus and kept two armies ready in the west. One, composed mostly of infantry and a few units of cavalry, were to man the frontier defenses and delay any Mongol advances for long enough to allow the second unit, which was composed of elite cavalry, to reach the trouble point and crush the invading force. By placing the latter a little behind the frontiers, the superior mobility of the Mongols could be neutralized. This was supported politically, with every effort being made to sow discord among the Mongols and their allies. This proved supremely effective, and by 1280 CE, his commanders were routinely defeating Mongol armies and launching sorties of their own to the west of the Indus. While these two changes brought prosperity to the Sultanate, for Balban himself, they would only bring grief. In 1286 CE, his eldest son and heir apparent, Muhammad, was killed in a skirmish with the Mongols. By now, Balban's stern and rigid attitude in court had percolated into his personal life as well. Devastated by his son's death, but too proud to display his grief to even his own family, Balban quickly slipped into a depression and all but withdrew from public life. He died a year later, now a broken man, having effectively ruled the Sultanate for 45 prosperous years. Before we go, I'd like to announce that the website for the podcast is now live, and you can find the link to it in the description of the show. I will be putting up the transcripts of all the episodes there. And although at the moment there are no maps, I intend to work on them soon. So please do check out the website, and I would appreciate any feedback or reviews that you might have. If you have any questions that you'd like to ask me about this period, please feel free to drop in an email at armchairhistorian.contact@gmail.com, which is also mentioned in the description to the show, and I'll do my best to answer them in subsequent podcasts. Next time, we'll be taking a break from the narrative and going on a quick tour through India in the last quarter of the 13th century. In particular, we'll look at what was happening in peninsular India south of the Vindhyas. Because not very long from now, the Sultanate's armies will march into the Deccan, and familiarity with the landscape will help us immensely. So thank you for joining me, and hope to see you soon in the next episode.